Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump has paused military aid and intelligence for Ukraine. He has also threatened Russia with new sanctions. Furthermore, is the EU really considering a new arms race? Is it preparing for war against Russia? Does anyone take the Europeans seriously anymore? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He is an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Mark here in Moscow. It's been a very tumultuous week. We have the Trump administration, at least according to media reports, and some members of the administration, that military and intelligence support for Ukraine has been cut off, or at least almost all of it. At the same time, President Trump has threatened Russia with more sanctions, which is kind of hard to believe after 16 rounds of sanctions. It's difficult to determine where else he could possibly go. Is this all part of the negotiating strategy? And is this message, when it comes to military aid to Ukraine and intelligence to Ukraine, is this an equal message to the Europeans and not necessarily the Russians? Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think that's the primary intent of what we've seen is Trump wants to force Russia and the Kiev regime and Ukraine into negotiations. He has promised to his domestic public in the world that he is going to bring peace. So he's using what leverage he has to force both sides, which, it must be said, are not interested in peace negotiations, neither one of them, except on their own terms, not as things are on the battlefield right now. And he's using what leverage he has with the Kiev regime in Ukraine. That leverage is immense. It is the majority of the military and financial support that props up the regime. And the intelligence is something, the satellite data, the signals intelligence is always severely underestimated in the importance that has had in propping up the Kiev regime on the battlefield for the last 3 years. With Russia, that leverage is very little. He's made vague threats about sanctions and tariffs. I don't know exactly what he would place. There's not a substantial amount of U.S.-Russian trade at the moment, except in uranium that the U.S.
And fertilizer.
Yeah. So that doesn't make any sense. And I think he just likes the word tariffs.
Mark, staying with you, I mean, the one of the shiny little objects that's always presented in front of the Russians from the West is sanction relief. And even that doesn't really have a lot of traction when it comes to Russia.
No. And in fact, that's the kind of the contradiction, or maybe it is an attempt, a clumsy attempt, I would say, at a carrot and stick approach. We can either ease the sanctions, right? And they're obviously, the Trump administration has put forward to the Treasury Department, look and see what sanctions we can get rid of quickly and easily. And at the same time, he's making vague statements about sanctions, and because the next sanctions after the 24,000 that Russia has is the one that will make their economy shrink and fail. And it's very poor leverage. And I don't think actually that making threats like this at this point in the negotiations is going to win him favors, in negotiations with Russia. They don't feel they are in a place. They're not worried about sanctions. Removal of sanctions is not their priority.
That's right.
Because the Russian economy is doing more or less pretty good. In fact, it's growing at a faster rate than the U.S. and European.
Well, and you and I both live here. It's burning on all cylinders. I mean, the economy is overheating. I mean, there's so much activity and so much money in the economy now. George, meanwhile, there is it's being kind of pitched as a U.S.-Ukraine summit. in Riyadh. I mean, remarkable how things change so quickly. I mean, I just thought it was a quick Zoom call and partners were working together. Now it's like, we'll have a separate venue. We'll have a cafeteria monitor there and all that. I mean, the tone of it is changing a lot. Okay. What could possibly the United States and Ukraine actually talk about that hasn't been publicly talked about in the Oval Office, George?
Well, I think probably what will happen in Saudi Arabia is that they will sign this economic extraction agreement. Clearly, this is what Mike Waltz and Marco Rubio said, well, that the Ukrainians have now come round, and we're going to sign this agreement. The problem is, of course, that, where do you go from there? You know, Trump, when he first announces, or in his, he sends out a truth that declaring that, we're going to, Russia is pounding Ukraine, and we're going to impose sanctions and tariffs. And then 2 hours later, he has a news conference at the Oval Office, and he says, well, things are going well. You know, I'm getting on very well with the Russians. They seem very agreeable. And in fact, I'm having difficulties with the Ukrainians. So, and then on the issue, he was asked repeatedly about, well, what about this pounding? You were complaining earlier about that they're pounding Ukraine. So, that was, anybody would do the same thing in their shoes. So the question then is, okay, so they signed this economic extraction agreement.
And then what?
And then what exactly? Trump says, that ties us to Ukraine. Of course, Zelensky has said, no, that doesn't tie you at all. You know, we want these security guarantees. Trump isn't prepared to issue the security guarantees. And then again, I think Mark alluded to, there's the real problem. Well, what are you going to negotiate about? Russia clearly will not accept a ceasefire. That's what they're talking about. I mean, Waltz and Trump, they're talking about a ceasefire. We've got to get a ceasefire. Russia will not accept a ceasefire. Ukraine will not accept a ceasefire because for Ukraine, that would mean essentially ceding 20% of territory. No Ukrainian leader can survive, physically even survive, by agreeing to seceding 20% of territory. So then you've got a question of, well, what does Trump do then? You know, now that, you know, he's got all these negotiations and then, boom, there's no agreement on anything. So I think when it's going to be very difficult to figure out, because Trump is all over the place, which way he's going to go, whom will he try to pressure in order to get somewhere?
I think we're in the minority in this space in believing that this is far from over. Okay, unfortunately, it's far from over. Mark, the silver bullet for the Russian side to resolve this issue is its security guarantees. And that is something that's still not part of the conversation, though I will present that I think is very important, is that what went wrong in Istanbul, what went wrong with the Minsk Accord, you know, for most people, a few weeks ago, if you were mentioned either one of them, they wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about. Now it's making it into the public conversation, which I think is progress. And I think it's going to reveal the fraud that the West committed against Ukraine and Russia that brought this about. So when is Russia's core needs going to be addressed, Mark? Because that's what it needs to be done to have this to be resolved. And we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, we're not even anywhere close. I mean,
not even close.
Negotiations on Ukraine, you know, even between the U.S. and Russia, much less between Russia and the Kiev regime in Ukraine, haven't even begun, right? But there is a continual echo chamber where Western leaders, sometimes with each other, sometimes in the public sphere, yelling at each other, are talking about things and completely moot, like ceasefire and NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine and no-fly zones and other nonsense that is only actually encouraging Russia to have no interest whatsoever in any type, not only of a ceasefire, but of ending the conflict in a settlement whatsoever. And that might be part of the European strategy here. So, but I think actually the most interesting thing that's happening in Riyadh is not what they're talking about. I mean, I don't know whether this minerals deal is going to be resuscitated or not. The Americans viewed that as a type of security guarantee, the only one they were going to give the Ukrainians, but it would only have any effect if there actually was a peace settlement. So that they were talking about as that as part of their test.
Well, but, I mean, Mark, the whole minerals deal, quote unquote, because it involves more than that. It's just a sleight of hand. Those are the security guarantees. I mean, that's what it is.
It's a political gesture on both sides, as far as I'm concerned. But it's interesting that they're meeting in Riyadh, not in Washington, not in Ukraine, not in Europe, right? And Zelensky is not there. They're obviously attempting to isolate the Kiev regime representatives from the Europeans, from the Democrats and neocons in the U.S. who might be sympathetic for them. They're also trying to get them to get serious and put them in a psychological space where this is real negotiations. This is not a friendly meeting, right? It's very interesting, the choice of venue, and that Zelensky, whom they've obviously decided with, is someone that no one can possibly work with. In fact, we also had confirmation during the week that the U.S. is talking to potential replacements for Zelensky, which is probably also part of their pressure campaign. And they're considering Tymoshenko, the former prime minister, oligarch gas princess, Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, possibly even Kirilu, I like the dark Budanov, the sociopathic Kiev regime's military intelligence chief.
Well, I mean, let me throw that to George here. I mean, is just a pressure program here, a pressure tactic here that slowly but surely isolating Zelensky? Because in the second part of the program, we're going to talk about anything but isolation for Zelensky. We're going to talk about Europe. But is this the American gambit here?
Well, it's possible that it seems very strange because the people that they're talking to, like Tymoshenko and Poroshenko, are, you know, yesterday's men or women, and, you know, the day before yesterday's men or women. I mean, they're not in any way plausible candidates as replacements for
Zelensky. But George, doesn't that speak of the lack of the democratic norms in Ukraine? There's no alternative to Zelensky. I mean, that's by design, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. There is no mechanism to replace him other than in some kind of a coup. I mean, they could always arrange some coup and someone takes over. There's a danger about a coup is that the whole place could just disintegrate. I mean, the Americans have a lot of experience when they organize coups, like the one against Ngo Dinh Diem in South Vietnam. The place just disintegrated, and that just sucked in the United
States. We all know with the best of plans, it always ends up in disaster. Why the powers that be can't recognize that is another topic. Right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion of some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. You know, Mark, the second half of the program, because I wanted to keep a clear differentiation between what Trump and his people are trying to do and what those wacky Europeans are trying to do here. I mean, this is bad. It's even just bad theater, talking about hundreds of billions of dollars are going to be invested in, you know, Ukraine now and forever, nothing about Ukraine without you. I mean, these are all old slogans, and it hasn't helped Ukraine at all. As a matter of fact, it's only hurt Ukraine on the battlefield here. Can you explain this? Is just this kabuki theater, or is this a self-help group, these people? George and I have talked about it at great length. I have no real intelligent answer to what they're doing. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, so the European leaders had another emergency EU summit during the week, which Politico was billing as the EU war summit. This was the war summit. They're getting ready for war. War against who? War against Trump?
I thought the whole thing was about peace.
The Europeans have no interest in peace whatsoever. In fact, the only one who has any interest in peace right now, as things stand, is Trump. And that has to be said. But the Europeans are perhaps, one of the furthest away. And there was panic. There is desperation and there is moral outrage, right? There is moral outrage against the United States. There's moral outrage that Russia is daring to win this conflict, that increasingly they're having to admit it. They're admitting that their own militaries are decrepit and deteriorated and that their stockpiles are empty, hence the need to rebuild Europe's military industrial complex. They make grandiose statements. Yeah,
well, Mark, speaking of the military industrial complex in Europe, that can be figured out and revved up by September this year, or 10 years from September.
Yeah, 10 years. And here's the problem. The European military industrial complex is, in 20 some different scattered little parts. So however much money they throw into it, it will never have the of scale production that countries like Russia and China and the United States have. They'll never be a military great power. And this 850 billion euros is supposed to magically come out of where? Debt, of course. They want to go even further into debt than they already are. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. They're not going to get the money. It's not going to happen on the scale they think. And it certainly won't have the military effectiveness. What's more, the Europeans are not a military orientated populations now. They don't have the will to fight for Europe's geopolitical interests, whether on Europe's borders or in Africa or anywhere else. European countries are having problems with military recruitment.
But that was the Americans' job, right, George? That's what the Americans were supposed to do for them. George, this posturing, it would be comical if it weren't so tragic, because people, young men are dying, Russians and Ukrainians are dying in Ukraine in this war. We all want it to come to an end. But what is it, for me, the Europeans, they cannot imagine that Russia could win against them, of course. I think the issue of Ukraine is epiphenomenal to all of this here. It's just that Europe, they believe so much of their own propaganda about themselves as the garden of humanity, almost infallible. They're almost kind of like, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union circa 1968, it's more a loss of faith in themselves. They've never liked the Americans. They have no respect for the Americans because they know the Americans have no respect for them. There's no love lost here, irrespective of all the nonsense you hear about the transatlantic relationship, George.
Well, the hysteria that we're being subjected to right now is very familiar to anyone who has followed European politics over decades, because anything has been true of this transatlantic alliance for the past 75 years is that there is this perpetual obsession on the part of the Europeans that they will be abandoned by the Americans. They're going to abandon us. They don't care about us. Their security guarantees are worthless. Let's go back to the time of the 1960s. There was again the obsession, the Americans are not going to sacrifice New York and Boston for Dusseldorf and Bonn. And the Americans, in an exasperated way, deployed their Jupiter missiles in Italy and Turkey, which of course led to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So this is, and then of course in the 1980s when they deployed the Euro missiles. Again, the only reason the Americans did that is that the Europeans kept whining to them about how panicked they are about the Russians. There's nothing new about that. But the strange thing is about this current issue with Ukraine is that this was an American project. The Americans were the ones who initially pushed this. They wanted this Ukraine. They wanted to bludgeon Ukraine into NATO. And it was the French, Sarkozy at the time, and then Angela Merkel, who were kind of hesitant about this. No, I don't think this is a good idea. This is not going to end well. And you know, the Americans had to temper their enthusiasm. And this went on. And again, even after 2014, it was the Americans who kept pushing this. And then suddenly the Europeans adopted this policy as their own. Then they became preoccupied with it. And then when there was a change in administrations, they were left holding the bag. You know, they say, well, now, you know, they're the ones now pushing the policy that they themselves, you know, rightly were a little skeptical of, because they're the ones who have to live there. They're the ones who have to live with the Russians. They're the ones who are dependent on cheap Russian energy. But now they've embraced it, that we don't care about Russian energy. We don't care about anything. All we care about is Ukraine.
Yeah, well, Mark, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, I might get strongly attacked for saying this, but I mean, Zelensky feels betrayed. Well, of course he feels betrayed. He believed the empire. The Europeans feel betrayed, yeah, because they believe the empire. Geopolitics is not about how do you feel. Geopolitics is relative strength to your adversaries and competitors. I mean, the rhetoric that's coming out of Europe is just juvenile. Okay, what did you expect to happen? You gave all your leverage away, and you're going to be betrayed? I mean, shame on you. That's how I look at it, Mark.
Yeah, whether we're talking about the regime in Kiev or the Europeans, none of these would-be proxies of the United States ever seem to learn the historical record that, you know, the Kurds, the Afghan national government that the U.S. formed there, that the Vietnamese, they have never learned the lesson of how the U.S. disposes of its proxies when there is political change in Washington, or whether they give up on the sunk cost fallacy of whatever conflict that they are engaged in. And it seems that the Europeans at this point are more ideologically committed to the continuance of U.S.-led global hegemony and this conflict in Ukraine as part of it than, well, certainly more than the current American administration is. We had Macron during this week say that there would only be peace in Europe, that France would only be safe from Russia if Russia was pacified by you and what army, right? You can't defeat Russia in Ukraine. Even with the Americans fighting beside you, you were losing. Now you want to go it alone. I mean, this is just fantasy land. And it is only going to you know, of course, they're ultimately trying to draw the U.S. back into the conflict. That is the ultimate goal of everything they're doing. And they are trying to continue it to the best of their ability. They are trying to spoil what Trump is trying to do. And that is making him furious at the European leaders, which is going to cause more and more damage to the vaunted transatlantic relationship.
You know, George, Denmark's prime minister, Frederiksen, meanwhile, sidebar, Trump is going to steal Greenland. But, you know, the prime minister's focus is obviously somewhere else. Peace in Ukraine is more dangerous than the ongoing war. I mean, You're basically attacked by your patron taking Greenland away from you, but the ongoing war is better than peace. What are these people smoking? I mean, I'm sorry. How do you interpret something like that?
It is just completely nuts. And of course, Denmark is a joke. I mean, it's nowhere near Ukraine. It doesn't have any armed forces to speak of. So anyone can posture and, you know, beat their chest in belligerence when they don't actually have to sacrifice anything. But there's no question what the Europeans are now trying to do is to, you know, thwart any possibility of a peace agreement. And this is, I mean, it used to be the Americans used to do this kind of thing when the Europeans had diplomatic initiatives, such as in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now it's the Europeans. What can we do to thwart it? All of this, all, you know, everything that they're doing now is in response to Trump you know, suggesting that, hey, with a peace agreement might be better than the continuation of the war. And this, you know, for years and years, the European position was the same as the Biden administration position. Well, we just got to continue the war. And, you know, at some point, Putin is going to come to the negotiating table. So let's just keep this.
George and Mark, it's interesting if you look at the European press. I don't know if you are aware of this, particularly for you, Mark, because you live here too, that Russia's almost in collapse state right now. I mean, this is what the Atlantic magazine. It's Ukraine that's winning the war of attrition. This just came out a couple days ago. I mean, this is just fantastic here, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, it is so delusional. It's because they're ideologically possessed. When you're ideologically possessed, you cannot process real life, real time data, Mark.
Yeah, they are completely in a propaganda bubble of their own creation. This is absolute military nonsense. I mean, it's worse than nonsense. And maybe they've convinced themselves that they actually believe it. It's this classic, now already classic Russophrenia. On one hand, they're screaming that, oh, we need to build up our powerful militaries because the great Russian bear is about to overrun Ukraine and invade Lisbon next week. And on the other hand, Russia is a failure of a state and it's about to collapse. I mean, it's such laughable scaremongering propaganda. And right now for Europeans, the threat of Russia invading NATO, which is, first of all, never mind the nuclear strategic deterrent or anything like that, right? It completely is meant to obscure the real
crime. All right, I'm sorry, I have to jump in, gentlemen. We have a hard break here on the fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.